I've always just been the type of person who tends to like run into difficulty rather than run away from difficulty. So, you know, so I'm just like, oh, okay, like I can't see or balance very well. Let me take ballet and be in dance class for like 3 to 6 hours a day.
Well, I've definitely seen wonderful videos of you on your Instagram dancing like a fiend. And fills me with joy every time.
Yeah, I think part of my emotional makeup that when people say, oh, well, you can't do that because you're this, you know, I'm always just like, watch me.
Hello, on today's episode of Shelf Life, we're talking about mothers, daughters, and lovers. Two books, Lucy by Jamaica Kincaid and My Education by Susan Choi. Join me with Meredith Toulousan after this.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. President Trump says the U.S. has paused a possible military strike against Iran. In a post on Truth Social, Trump said Iran and other countries in the region ask Washington to hold off because the outlines of a deal had been reached. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports from Tel Aviv.
President Trump wrote on social media Saturday night that the U.S. was, quote, locked and loaded and ready to go against the Islamic Republic of Iran, end quote. But then he said Iran and other Middle Eastern countries had asked him to hold off, subject to rapidly making a deal, one that would include the immediate and total reopening of the Strait of Hormuz and an end to Iran's nuclear threat. Mayer, a semi-official news agency sponsored by the Iranian government, dismissed Trump's claims as, quote, simply a new lie, citing unnamed Iranian military officials. President Trump has threatened big attacks on Iran in the past, only to back off. Israel, a U.S. partner in the war against Iran, has yet to comment. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
It's a busy last weekend of campaigning ahead of Michigan's contentious U.S. Senate primary Tuesday. As Michigan Public's Steve Carmody reports, the primary has implications far beyond the Great Lakes State.
The primary between Congresswoman Haley Stevens and former Detroit public health official Abdul El-Sayed is seen as a battle between the Democratic Party's establishment and progressive wings. Stevens has garnered a slew of endorsements from party leaders, including U.S. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. Meanwhile, El-Sayed has the backing of progressive stars, including Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Michigan's primary battle is not only about the direction of the National Democratic Party, but also whether Democrats or Republicans control the U.S. Senate next year. For NPR News, I'm Steve Carmody in Saginaw, Michigan.
Three people are dead and nearly two dozen injured after a bomb detonated outside a restaurant in central Moscow last night. NPR's Charles Maines report, Russian authorities are labeling a terrorist attack.
The explosion happened outside an upscale Italian restaurant in Kudrinsky Square, one of the so-called Seven Sisters of Stalin-era skyscrapers ringing central Moscow. Russia's anti-terrorism committee said an unidentified woman tried to enter the restaurant's terrace carrying a box. She was stopped by a security guard when the bomb exploded, killing them both as well as a restaurant patron. Russian media reports several high-ranking military officials were at the restaurant at the time of the explosion for a private dinner on the terrace. Security at the restaurant was heavy. Russia has stepped up protection of its top brass amid a spate of assassinations and attempted killings that it blames on Ukraine. Charles Maines, NPR News.
Ukrainian drone strikes killed at least five people across Russia today, according to local officials. They also again hit a warehouse belonging to Wildberries, the largest online retailer in Russia. This is NPR News. Flight attendants are on strike across WestJet. Against WestJet, the second largest airline in Canada, hundreds of flights have been canceled. The union says the workers are not being paid for some duties performed on the ground before and after flights. WestJet says it has made an offer to address that but was rejected. The strike comes in a busy travel weekend. Tomorrow is a holiday in Canada. Americans' ideas about how to dispose of their bodies when they die are changing. Many people are considering greener methods like human composting. Scott Massioni from member station WYPR reports Maryland is the home of the largest human composting facility in the nation.
Human composting is when a body's put into a container with mulch and fungi to naturally decompose and come out as soil. That soil can go to loved ones or be donated to environmental projects. Earth Funeral in Elkridge, Maryland, runs the largest body composting facility in the country and has the capacity to process 126 bodies at once. Adrian Mathura bought a plan to be composted.
It's like my final gift to the earth when I die.
14 states have legalized composting as a way to dispose of bodies. For NPR News, I'm Scott Massioni in Baltimore.
At the box office, Spider-Man Brand New Day made history in its first weekend. It brought in $355 million in ticket sales, the second biggest North American opening after Avengers Endgame, which opened with $357 million. This is the fourth time actor Tom Holland has played the web-slinging crime fighter. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Schwab, where investors have a range of choices to pursue investing goals, from self-directed investing to full-service wealth management, all in one place. More at schwab.com. This is NPR.
I've always just been the type of person who tends to like run into difficulty rather than run away from difficulty. So, you know, so I'm just like, oh, okay, like I can't see or balance very well. Let me take ballet and be in dance class for like 3 to 6 hours a day.
Well, I've definitely seen wonderful videos of you on your Instagram dancing like a fiend. And like, fills me with joy every time.
Yeah, I think part of my emotional makeup that when people say, oh, well, you can't do that because you're this, you know, I'm always just like, watch me.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. Hello. When the award-winning journalist Meredith Toloosan published their memoir Fairest in 2020, it was widely praised for the unflinching honesty with which Toloosan told a complex story of gender and identity on their own terms. It's no surprise then to find a similar animating spirit, at once vulnerable and forthright, at the heart of the two novels Toloosan has picked as favourites for this episode of Shelf Life: Jamaica Kincaid's modern classic Lucy, published in 1990, and Susan Choi's novel My Education, published in 2013. In both stories, the reader is presented with assertive protagonists, alive to their passions and desires, people for whom identity is sometimes messy, often urgent, and always singular. For Toloosan, who made their name as a journalist exploring transgender identity, the personal and the political are never far apart. So many of us have to be Swiss Army knives, they have said. I can't just be an author. Trans people can't just be models or actors or doctors. We also have to perform the political and emotional labor of being activists. Meredith, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Meredith, we obviously know each other. You have a house in Barrieville, which is just down the road from the bookstore. And I have seen you in the store often, wandering the shelves, looking at books. You really can't keep away from a bookshelf. I wonder how hard it was for you to narrow your choice down to two books.
It was impossible. I mean, I essentially chose these two books because I was thinking about the concerns that I find myself really obsessed about. And I had just taught a class, a lecture on intersectional writing. And these two books happened to be two that really stuck out to me. And I love them both as literature, but also personal favorites that I find myself coming back to over and over again and being delighted by in various ways.
We see the term intersectional a lot in the media now and culture. How does that apply in a work of literature for you?
When I talk about intersectional writing, I usually talk about characters or situations or events or a confluence of all of those elements in which people's lived experiences or identities don't just follow one linear trajectory. If you think about a lot of white written novels, especially from 30 years ago, usually, you know, it involves a central character, middle class. The classic struggle is alcoholism or job loss, something like that. There is a central crisis, and the novel pivots around how to resolve the central crisis. One of the things about living in America as a minority who is simultaneously an immigrant and trans and albino and Asian is I'm always looking for narratives that don't have that singular linear axis, because for so many people, that's no longer the case, right? Like we can't fit our experiences and our lives into this form that was built around white middle class consciousness. And so I'm always looking for books that sort of twist and complicate those various elements of identity and lived experience. And I think both Lucy and My Education certainly do that.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin. My guest today is Meredith Terlousen. So Meredith, one of the two books you've chosen today is Lucy by Jamaica Kincaid. On the surface, it's a very simple story that follows a year in the life of a young woman from the West Indies who comes to work as an au pair in New York. But that synopsis really doesn't do justice to the scope of Kincaid's achievement, which is huge. I wonder if you can take me back to when you first read it.
I first read Lucy as a junior in college at Harvard. I remember that it was winter. And the reason I remember that it was winter was because when I read the line at the beginning of the book, how Lucy saw that it was sunny out and she came out in the sort of summer dress and realized her big mistake as soon as she left the house, I just felt this sort of deep, deep sense of identification, because I too have experienced that, of seeing this like bright winter day and only having associations of warmth. But also I think finding a character like her, highly empowered, highly brazen, forthright, have her own opinions type of woman in what is supposed to be a subservient position was just deeply, deeply inspiring to me, and was what I needed at a time when really my model for being a minority in the US, and I had only been in the US for less than 5 years at that point, was to get along and to assimilate and to not question the things that people were telling me and to be meek and to be small. And I think just having that example of that book gave me other ways of being in the world as a minority in America. That's a gift that I cherished from the moment that I read Lucy, and that I cherish to this day. And I've continued to assign it and teach it. So I've probably read it 3 or 4 times at this point.
Wow. Well, meek is certainly not a word you would apply to Lucy, a character with so much life, and she is not going to really give an inch to anyone.
Absolutely. And I think what's really wonderful about her is that her views are just always unexpected and don't align with one specific ideas about what a person from her background is supposed to feel. Like, she has this really combative relationship with her mother and feels enormous affinity for her white employer and also enormous affection for the white children that she's raising, while at the same time not doing so because they're white. She continues to be deeply suspicious of white culture, but she is able to see the world on her own terms and make decisions for herself about how she feels about the world. And that just feels really rare to me. It's certainly, you know, she's certainly a type of person I aspire to be, but am not, never quite.
It's interesting to me because I think that's very much what Lucy is essentially doing, is sort of owning the colonial history that she comes from, owning being a black woman in a country of a lot of white privilege. I mean, one of the things I found in this book so powerful and moving is she is as in control as she can be of who she is. She's not willing to sort of pass on other people's terms. She's not going to grovel, is she, or be cowed. There's a wonderful scene in the book where Mariah is describing the beauty of daffodils. And for Mariah, daffodils mean spring. They mean a kind of pleasure in having a garden, in being a certain kind of person in the world. And for Lucy, what it refers to is the oppressiveness of having to recite Wordsworth's poem to daffodils in an island in the West Indies with a colonial power where you're never going to grow up and see a daffodil. And the vision that Lucy has is wanting to scythe the daffodils. She wants to cut them all down. And I just thought that was so singular and effective.
I just remember being confronted with my own racist expectations of what that character should be like and how she should behave and who she should be, and being presented with this deeply, deeply complex portrait of somebody who has her own sets of opinions about everything that are deeply, deeply unexpected. I just found the existence of this character so explosive in terms of my life and in terms of the possibilities that, you know, that I felt like I could occupy as a person of color in America. And my entire approach to being in America, really up to that point, was the sort of classic narrative of Asian assimilation, because those were the models that I was presented with. As long as you put your head down, as long as you do work, as long as you get your A's, you'll be fine. But really, Lucy was a novel where I was just like, oh, like, there are other ways to do this. There are other ways to present oneself among these people. And one of those ways is to really confront the way in which you're so automatically patronized when you're a racial minority who is an immigrant, and so automatically assumed to be less capable than other people, and how and that you can either accept or get along with that definition of you because it's what the social order wants you to do, or you can have your own opinions, because then when you do that, then maybe you don't sacrifice a piece of yourself. But I also feel like one of the most wonderful moments in the book for me was the moment when we find out that Lucy had a brother, and that her mother poured all of her efforts at betterment and education, all of her praise, all of her assumptions about who would do well in the world onto Lucy's brother and not Lucy. And that the only reason why her mother decided that her brother was better was because he was a boy. And that was the moment when you see the way in which Lucy's struggle isn't singular. She is battling forces of race and class in America, but she also doesn't have a place back home, because back home she is assumed to be inferior because she's a woman. So then she has to figure out how to make her way in the world, knowing that she is deeply underestimated wherever she is. Those are narratives that I'm deeply, deeply drawn to that are so much more complex than people and characters with one big crisis, right? With the whale or the alcoholism or the job, right?
You're listening to Shelf Life, and I'm talking with Meredith Toulousan about two of her favorite books. It's a very deceptively simple novel, but there's so much in there for me about perception and ways of seeing. So often what Jamaica Kincaid reminds you is that we're all creatures of our upbringing and our backgrounds and our experiences of the world. There's a moment where Jamaica Kincaid, as Lucy, says that for Mariah, the world is round and everyone knows that it's round. But for Lucy, the world is flat and you can fall off at any moment. And that really resonated with me because it's a reminder that so many people live in a place where everything could fall away at any moment without the kind of certainties that Mariah has.
And the amazing thing about this book is the way that Jamaica Kincaid has the ability to just sort of like veer in these super unexpected directions. You know, like in the middle of this sort of like sentence praising Mariah, praising their friendship and the way that Mariah appreciates her, she'll say something like, "We were sitting at the dining table, which she got from Finland. You know, I never thought that it was possible for somebody to just go somewhere, see something so large, and then decide, oh, you know, like I'm just gonna bring this halfway across the world at exorbitant expense," which is just so, is so wonderful and savvy how she's able to sort of occupy these contradictions, right? Like show appreciation for her employer while at the same time also really exposing and reading, you know, Mariah's blind spots, right? And to the degree that it's an autobiographical novel, what I find so wonderful about it is that it does simultaneously have that quality of being almost memoiristic in the sense that the events kind of happen haphazardly and there isn't that classic dramatic arc. And yet at the same time, the more I read the book, the more it feels so intentional and every piece seems to have its place and all, every revelation and every outcome has these reverberations to previous moments in the book. You know, especially at the end when she decides to leave her employer and Mariah is extremely resentful and exposes the way that as much as they can be friends, there's still this gulf of class between them. There's still an expectation for the white person to be the person who is in control of the relationship. And Mariah couldn't handle the fact that Lucy makes this decision on her own.
Yeah, there is a lovely grace note, though, where at the very end, you see them again having lunch or dinner, and you understand in that moment that this has sort of freed them to just be friends and to no longer have that employer-employee relationship. And that made me very happy in that moment. I was like, I'm glad they can have a friendship now. But it took a separation, you know, for that to happen.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting question, right? Like what happens as I was talking to you about that moment of, you know, going to Finland and finding a piece of furniture and bringing it back and how so characteristically white that is, you know, like it's one of the really kind of like fascinating aspects for me of American upward mobility. I haven't exactly done that, you know, but I've been to São Paulo and seen a pretty big painting and brought it home. You know, it is really interesting to just sort of think about what it means to come from a background in which I've always perceived myself as being on the outside of these types of events. These are things that happen to other people, not to me. And then waking up one morning and being like, oh, I'm an executive editor at Condé Nast and I make decisions about, you know, like what is in style or cool, right? I'm the person in the media who is seen as an insider. And I think that's also really a really fascinating aspect of intersectional identity, is that to a certain degree, there will always be those types of people like us. The system needs exceptionalized minorities because it's the only way that we can continue to believe that we are actually, in some sense, moving towards a progressive democratic society.
In a sense, it can be easy to be seduced and become complacent by success. But if you are conscious of where you come from and the identities you bring to the table with you, you always are able to bring yourself back to the outside looking in as opposed to the inside looking out.
I just remember, you know, kind of like around 2015, when I was hired as a staff writer at BuzzFeed, which was a position that just reached millions of people on a regular basis. One of the things that I promised myself was that I couldn't be the type of minority who wouldn't speak out in order to preserve my position.
You moved to the United States, I think, when you were 15.
Yes.
Can you describe your impressions at that point as someone who had grown up in the Philippines, arriving in Los Angeles?
We were presented in the Philippines with the best that America has to offer through TV. We see lifestyles of the rich and famous. We see TV shows about skyscrapers in New York City and Hollywood. And we landed at LAX, but my family lived in the Inland Empire in Chino, California, you know, which is not Hollywood, which is smog and cattle ranches and the smell of manure and working class neighborhoods, et cetera, et cetera. And so that first year was definitely a really, really significant culture shock as far as adjusting my expectations. You know, and I've just led a very strange life and a very haphazard one. The only reason I even knew to apply to Harvard was because my teacher, one of my math teacher at the time, happened to say, oh, you have to pay attention to this test, the PSAT, because that's how a lot of colleges recruit students. And I realized that it was actually possible for me to apply to these elite colleges, right? So I think there's this very weird alternative life in which I would have just stayed in California, gone to a state school, probably become some sort of professional, right? One of my sisters is a nurse and the other is a human resources specialist. That was the kind of life that is usually expected of people like me.
It's a reminder that so much can rest on intervention, on someone saying, you might want to think about this.
Right. I mean, I think this is one thing that is very hard for a lot of people who have been raised with cultural privileges to understand, is that so much of what it means to not have cultural privilege isn't just the fact that you're precluded from having options. It's that you're not even aware that those options exist in the first place for you to be excluded from them.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today is the writer and journalist Meredith Toulousan. Meredith, you talked about Harvard a little bit now. Can you give me a little background to realizing at Harvard that you were transgender?
I spent a good portion of my Harvard undergraduate life thinking of myself as a gay man. And then, speaking of happenstance, my undergraduate house, Adams House, has a tradition every year called Drag Night, in which men dress in women's clothes and vice versa, less so vice versa. And so I was just inducted into this tradition. You know, people who knew who I was said, oh, you just look like a woman. And people who didn't know who I was thought that I was a woman. And I thought it was strange that this felt good. You know, at the time, it was just like, oh, they think I'm a woman. I kind of like it. So I think that sort of just started this entire kind of like exploration of playing with gender. I didn't use the word trans at the time. At the time, I just said that I feel like I'm between a man and a woman. And I, being the plucky undergraduate that I was, of course, wrote a one-person performance piece at the end of my senior year and performed it to much, I don't know if acclaim is the right word, certainly notoriety.
I remember from the book that it's a pretty sexual piece.
I didn't really perceive it as sexual at the time. I just perceived it as, you know, like what's necessary in mm-hmm. order to explore gender. How does one do that? How does one do that without being naked? How does one do that without exploring one's relationships, one's sexual relationships with other people? But yeah, like I ended up naked on the front page of the Harvard Crimson. I was threatened with arrest by one of the Harvard administrators. It's strange to think about that now, given, you know, like I'm not really a particularly buttoned up person, but I definitely live further away from my body in terms of my work than I used to.
At the same time, I admired your frankness in Ferris and your decision as a writer. And I think it's probably a decision anyone who writes a memoir has to make of how honest you're going to be about sex. I wonder how much of a challenge that was for you.
You know, things never stop me at the writing stage because I always feel like that's not the stage in which I need to exercise any type of prudence or control. I was writing those scenes for myself, and I think that made them probably like easier to write than if I had been thinking about the repercussions for showing them in public. And then by the time that I wrote them, they felt really important to the book. So then it was easier to surmount my hesitations around writing those scenes.
The book begins with you visiting Harvard for an alumni event. You had arrived at Harvard as a gay man, and you returned to Harvard as a woman. Mm-hmm. In that section, there's a moment when I think a former classmate says to you words to the effect of, "You haven't changed." And it's such a illuminating moment because, of course, you've changed hugely. Why do you think he said that, and how did you respond to that?
Well, it's just a very funny thing, right, that one of the things about being Asian is that we tend to age more slowly than Caucasian people. And so I think part of the reason why he said that was visually, I definitely looked more similar right. to how I looked in undergrad than other people at the reception, since this was my 20-year reunion. And I happened to, at the time, you know, was sporting a short haircut. It was a really fascinating example of how gender isn't actually, in a lot of ways, what you look like. It's literally how you label yourself and people's relationships to that label and their expectations of you. Because for people who have not seen me for a long time and are seeing me again, the most salient thing for them is that I haven't really changed that much. I probably have gained 10 pounds, but from people's perspectives, I'm a lot more similar to some of our other classmates.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today is the writer and journalist Meredith Toulousan. We'll be back after this.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, chef and writer Eddie Wong. He'll talk to W. Kamau Bell about his new book, Come Undone. It's a semi-autobiographical romantic comedy. He'll also discuss the reasons why he stepped away from a hit television show based on his memoir, Fresh Off the Boat. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures, here on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, this afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Hey, theater fans, it's me, Tom Candela from Curtain Call. This week on the show, meet the creative team behind Being Somebody, the acclaimed father-daughter theatrical experience coming to the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center for one special performance on Thursday, August 6th at 7 p.m. Join me as I welcome Dr. Howard Mace, Marla Mace, and director Elizabeth Browning for a heartfelt conversation about storytelling, family, hope, and why it's never too late to begin a new chapter. That's Monday night at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm here with Meredith Toulousan, talking about two of her favorite books. Meredith, it's time to talk about My Education by Susan Choi. We've touched on it a few times in this conversation. It presents itself as one type of book when you're starting, which is, you know, this classic campus novel in which a female student is going to get entangled with a wily and duplicitous male professor. But that doesn't happen. I wonder... when you realize that this wasn't going to be a prototypical campus seduction novel.
Yeah, it's so funny just because I first read this book maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And I picked it up because I love campus novels. I love Susan Choi, and I love the sort of like arch tone of academic culture as mm-hmm. well. And so I was just mentally preparing myself for the sort of super witty, really fun campus novel. And then in the middle of it, I realized that the main character who I knew to be half Asian was specifically half Filipino. And then that B, she ends up having an affair not with her male professor, Nicolas Brodeur, but her male professor's wife, Martha, who is also a professor at this unnamed university, which is obviously Cornell, because Susan Choi went to Cornell for her MFA, as I did. Reading the book also came at a time when I was really checking in with myself about my own sexuality and my own relationship to that sexuality. I had, at that point, you know, certainly like made out and hooked up with women, but I had never thought of them as potential long-term partners. And I think reading My Education just really opened up my consciousness to, oh, actually, you know, like I could very well see myself being the type of person who has been just socialized and oriented towards being attractive to and being attracted to men, but that there is a world in which, you know, in which someone of a different gender can destabilize that perception of myself. Mm. I don't think that I was fully aware of that until I read My Education, in part because of the fact that, as bisexuals go, Regina Gottlieb is probably like the most minimal one can get as a bisexual person while still having this like really long drawn torrid affair with a woman. And I think ironically, the fact that this affair was, you know, in some ways such a blip in her life made me feel in some way comforted that it's just like, oh yeah, like one can be bisexual in that way. I might actually be even more bisexual than Regina, despite not ever having had a long-term relationship with a woman.
It's interesting because Regina and Martha certainly see themselves as heterosexual women sort of caught up in an unexpected same-sex love affair. And Regina says at one point that the fact they're both women is the least relevant fact of all. And I questioned that. I was like, is it the least relevant fact? And why would she think that?
I think what fascinates me about the novel, and I'm not 100% sure that it's able to pull it off, but I read the ambition of the novel as wanting to be simultaneously about race while not revealing itself to be about race and being about sexuality without revealing itself to be about sexuality. I find that sort of sense of oscillation really fascinating in the book because it's a type of book where when you're reading text, you don't necessarily maintain the image of the character in your head at all times. And so when I read Regina, the fact of her being Asian and brown, she's described as brown, doesn't stand out to me until she's in specific situations, right? Like until she has an encounter with the police in which she's presented as the agitator, or when she has, you know, these encounters with her white professors. And then suddenly I sort of ask myself, oh, how does her brownness figure into this equation? I kind of have a similar response to her bisexuality. I sort of get the criticism that she treats her bisexuality as kind of tangential to the nature of her relationship with Martha. But at the same time, it's certainly relevant to the larger department and the student body. It makes it more tawdry for certain people. It gives it a sense of excitement for other people. And I think there's a certain way in which you kind of have to see around, this is a very writerly thing to say, that you kind of have to see around Regina as a character to be able to sort of like get to that truth, that even when she doesn't think that the two of them being women has these larger effects, certainly we experience that as readers.
She's very bold, Regina, and very forthright. Martha is in her late 30s and Regina is 21, I think. So it's an asymmetrical relationship. But Martha has so much more to lose. And Regina has nothing to lose, really. I think she says at one point, I could get on a Greyhound bus and head off into the sort of sunset and no one would know and no one would care. Whereas Martha is a married woman with a child. And I sometimes found Regina selfish.
She's certainly selfish. But it's part of the pleasure of young, feckless characters, right? I feel like for me, I deeply identify with Regina. Like, this is not big news. But I think in terms of social observation, there's something just really, really delicious about the reality of a 21-year-old Yale graduate student. This is somebody who is very book smart, who has been praised to high heaven for being book smart and has been well rewarded for being book smart and is now at the top university in the country for English, but is 21, you know, is an adult in certain ways, but doesn't completely know how to make adult decisions. For me, there's something just really, really delicious about us being able to believe that somebody who is in that type of position can perform all of these really haphazard actions and can be selfish in that way. 21-year-olds often are that selfish. And I guess I do find that pleasurable. I do find that tension really pleasurable to read about.
Correct me if I'm misremembering, but in Fairest, you describe a relationship you have with an older man, an academic, a visiting academic to Harvard.
Well, Rafe, yes. who I end up in a relationship with, we met when I was a senior at Harvard, and he was a new assistant professor at MIT. And he's an ethics professor, is the other relevant piece of information. We met in November of my senior year, went out on a date, and he was just like, no, I can't do this. We should just be friends. And so me, being me, I proceeded to spend the next few months, you know, like being around him at events, but flirting with other people. Until he finally saw me on a date like a month before my graduation. But he was an MIT professor. Like, I didn't see what the big deal was. But I think, obviously, in retrospect, it was actually challenging because he wanted to be perceived as a serious professor with serious thoughts. He wanted to present himself in a particular way to his department so that he would get tenure, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm.
This is Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and I'm talking to Meredith Toulousan, the author and journalist. Meredith, Michael Cunningham says that Susan Choi has written lines that could be framed and displayed at a sentence festival. The writing is beautiful. She really knows how to turn a phrase, doesn't she?
There's just something about the way Susan writes that is magic. And I think part of it is the fact that she's able to work in these multiple registers. The book has this very sort of high, very sort of grad school kind of tone, but it never reads as academic because it's steeped in the emotional lives of these people. And I think that that's just like a hallmark characteristic of her work, that her diction, the way that she phrases things, it's always operating in multiple dimensions that then produce these amazing, surprising turns of phrase. There is one scene in the book where we meet Regina's mother, who is presented as just really kind of vivacious.
She spends a lot of her retirement sailing the seas in on cruise liners.
So. Yeah, she's like in Europe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the way that Susan Choi is simultaneously so accurate about Filipino mothers and just so funny, I just found it so simultaneously impressive. And yet at the same time, just so like, do I feel uncomfortable? You know, she just sort of skates that line. I remember the one line I just was laughing for several minutes was when she's in, I think she was in Finland, and the mom says, oh, you know, like everybody here looks like daddy, Regina. And then Regina says, wait, aren't you in Finland? Oh, yes, but they're European. They all look the same. And then I just thought to myself, wow, like it's such an amazing and accurate reversal of the trope of, you know, of white people thinking that all minorities look the same, right?
Jamaica Kincaid was very influenced by her love of certain writers, including Charlotte Bronte. She read Jane Eyre when she was young. I think somewhere she said, I didn't want to be Jane Eyre. I wanted to be Charlotte Bronte. I wonder which writers you were reading in the Philippines as a young child.
Mm. I mean, the thing about the Philippine education system you have to understand is that the system was built by the American military. So we did not read racial minorities as young Filipino people because the American military wanted to present the rosiest picture. Of American life. So A Wrinkle in Time was a very important book for me. I remember reading Alice in Wonderland. I mean, it's funny because like as I'm writing fiction now, a lot of my fiction actually moves towards the speculative. And I think part of the reason is that a lot of the books that I really identified with when I was a kid were books that were set in other worlds. Jules Verne, certainly. because they couldn't identify with books that were set in America that were about the lives of white people in America. The only minority author that I remember reading as a kid was Rabindranath Tagore. And then when I got to the States, I ended up reading James Baldwin, E.M. Forster, André Gide, and a lot of 19th century authors. George Eliot is certainly an enormous, enormous influence.
One of the things that I love so much about George Eliot is you can read those novels and they're really a kind of social history of their time. What do you think that Jamaica Kincaid's Lucy and My Education by Susan Choi will say to people 100 or 200 years hence about these times? Do you think they work as a sort of social history?
I do think they do. I believe that 100 years from now, people will remember how we were grappling with how to live in a pluralistic society with the theoretical or philosophical understanding that people should be able to live their lives freely and equitably, but are struggling to figure out how that can actually manifest in the world. I feel like that aspect of those books will continue to exist. But at the same time, I also read them beyond the social histories that they portray. I feel like both of those books really exemplify the talents of singular writers who are just enormous pleasures to read and are just incredibly addictive. And wonderful in all of the ways that they are. And I think part of that, for me, certainly as a writer and as a person living in the world, it is how brazen they both are as writers and how difficult that can be, especially for minority women writers, because there's so many possible consequences to being a brazen woman who exhibits her abilities and talents and takes decisive actions. And I think both the major characters in these books, as well as the writers who wrote them, do exhibit those qualities of brazenness and confidence and performing actions that are unpopular, but that they are convinced are the right actions to take.
I really think you nailed it with the word brazen. And, you know, it strikes me at the same time that these are absolutely books and heroines, or protagonists at least, if not heroines, that could not have been created or written by men.
Absolutely. That's something that I've been thinking about a lot too, is the way in which our understanding of speculative fiction, our understanding of the future, is shaped by the largely male-dominated field that those types of fictions inhabit. Octavia Butler, Ursula Le Guin, Katie Martin, more recently being exceptions, but still. And that's something that I've been wrestling with, certainly in my work, is sort of what is a future reality in which people are still thinking about fashion and beauty? What is a future reality that expresses concerns that are not gendered male, is something that I've been asking about a lot in my work.
One of the qualities of certain sci-fi, Ursula Le Guin certainly comes to mind, is that they imagine worlds in which gender is very, very differently constructed, more malleable. Mm-hmm. Is that something that has drawn you to the work of someone like Ursula Le Guin or Octavia Butler?
Yeah, I mean, certainly The Left Hand of Darkness, it is a book that has influenced me a lot, as has the parable books of Octavia Butler, whose main character is gender nonconforming and is mistaken for a man, et cetera, et cetera. But also I'm really interested in the genderedness of large-scale decision-making and the many mistakes that we as a society are making that really endanger our future on this planet being predicated on decisions that are made primarily by men.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest, Meredith Taloussin. Meredith, I mentioned at the beginning that you have a house in Barryville or near Barryville. How has living here part-time been useful to you as a writer, or how has it influenced your work?
I think it's fair to say that we've been living here full-time. We've certainly spent 9 or 10 months out of the year in Barryville. And I think the fact that I spend my days not being around many people and being mostly around trees and the river and the lake has made a really, really big difference in terms of the way that I think of the world and the way that I think about my relationship to books and my relationship to writing. It used to be that I thought of books as something that's separate from living. But now when I read a book, it is my most ready access to other people's consciousness. It feels so much more like I'm hearing what somebody has to say and that my writing is me responding to the things that other people are telling me. When I read books, I've always been a voracious reader, but my reading has increased probably like at least 2, if not more, fold since I've moved to Barryville. And that's been a really welcome change.
So much is about sort of wherever you are these days is about fighting our tendency to be distracted. But I think being, as you say, in nature is one way in which we can anchor ourselves in the space to read and absorb.
Yeah. I recently read Jenny O'Dell's Is It How to Do Nothing? Which certainly was highly inspirational. I also recently read Haruki Murakami's What I Talk About When I Talk About Running, which really delves into the way that training for marathons and the sort of meditative practice of running has influenced his writing and him being able to sort of tune out distraction and do the things that he really wants to do in life. And those books have been really valuable and inspirational for me, even though I unfortunately have bad dancer knees, so I can't run. But I'm planning to swim again. I've been kind of lax on my swimming practice.
Well, here's to a lot of swimming in 2022. Meredith, thank you so much for taking time to be with me today and joining us for this episode of Shelf Life. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. It's such a pleasure.
We've been talking about Lucy by Jamaica Kincaid, which is published by Farrar Straus Giroux, and My Education by Susan Choi, published by Penguin. Fairest is also published by Penguin. My thanks to my producer, Ilya Maritz, to our sound engineer, and the composer of the music, Tim Wood. Thank you for listening. You can find this podcast and others like it on all good podcast platforms.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Neversink General Store, featuring catering for parties, meetings, and weddings, gourmet deli, pizzeria, and groceries inside a gas station. NeversinkGeneralStore.com, and from listeners like you.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, millions of Americans think they are allergic to penicillin, and the vast majority of them are not.
90% of people who believe that they are allergic to penicillin actually can tolerate it.
And why do these misdiagnoses matter?
We would save millions of dollars, just my healthcare system. So it must be in the billions.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
If you've got an amazing record collection, but you also need to downsize, why not give it to Radio Catskill? We're always taking donations of clean vinyl in good condition for our music sale. Donate today at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill.